The Briggs Plan became very popular with the Indian Army, which has used it in Nagaland, Mizoram, and Telangana. The BJP Chief Minister of Chhattisgarh, BJP is the right-wing Bharatiya Janata Party, the right-wing Hindu party, Raman Singh, announced that as far as his government was concerned, villagers who did not move into the camps would be considered Maoists. So in Bastar, for an ordinary villager just staying at home, living an ordinary life, became the equivalent of indulging in terrorist activity. So you can imagine, the constitution first criminalizes their way of life and makes them criminals, and now they've graduated into being terrorists. Along with a steel mug of black tea as a special treat, someone hands me a pair of earphones and switches on her little MP3 player. It's a scratchy recording of the then superintendent of police of Bijapur, D.S. Manhar, briefing a junior officer over the wireless about the rewards and incentives the state and central governments are offering to Jagrit, as in awakened villagers, meaning the villagers who agree to move out are being given incentives. He then gives clear instructions that villagers that refuse to surrender should be burnt, and journalists who want to cover Naxalites should be shot on sight. I'd read about this in the papers long ago. When the story broke, rumor has it that as a punishment, it's not clear to whom, the superintendent was transferred to the State Human Rights Commission. The Salva Judum was announced at a meeting of village mukhyas, village heads, in a village called Ambeli in June 2005. Between June and December, it burned, killed, raped, and looted its way through hundreds of villages of South Dantewara. The center of its operations were Bijapur and Bhairamgarh, near Bela Dila, where the SR Steel's new plant was proposed. Not coincidentally, those were also Maoist strongholds where the Jantana Sarkar, the people's governments, had done a great deal of work building water harvesting structures. The Jantana Sarkars became the special target of the Salva Judum's attack. Hundreds of people were killed in the most brutal ways. About 60,000 moved into camps, some voluntarily, others out of terror. Of these, about 3,000 were appointed as special police officers on a salary of 1,500 rupees, which is about $40 a month. The remaining hundreds of thousands of people went off the government radar. Many of them made their way to neighboring states, where they usually migrated to work as contract labor during the chili picking season. But tens of thousands fled into the forest, where they still remain, living without shelter, coming back to their fields and homes only in the daytime. In the slipstream of the Salva Judum, a swarm of police stations and camps appeared. The idea was to provide carpet security for a creeping reoccupation of Maoist-controlled territory. The assumption was that the Maoists would not dare to attack such a large concentration of security forces. The Maoists, for their part, realized that if they did not break that carpet security, it would amount to abandoning people whose trust they had earned and with whom they had lived and worked for 25 years. They struck back in a series of attacks on the heart of the security grid. On the 26th of January 2006, the PLGA attacked the Gangalore police camp and killed 7 people. On 17th July 2006, the Salva Judum camp at Erabor was attacked and 20 people were killed and 150 injured. You might have read about it, something like Maoists attacked the relief camp set up by the state government to provide shelter to the villagers who had fled from their villages because of terror unleashed by the Naxalites. On 13th December 2006, they attacked the Basaguda relief camp and killed 3 special police officers and a constable. On the 15th of March 2007 came the most audacious attack of them all. 120 PLGA guerrillas attacked the Rani Bodali Kanya Ashram, a girls' hostel that had been converted into a barrack for 80 Chhattisgarh police and SPOs, while the girls still lived in it as human shields. The PLGA entered the compound, cordoned off the annex in which the girls lived, and attacked the barracks. 55 policemen and SPOs were killed. None of the girls were hurt. The attack on Rani Bodli caused an uproar in the country. Human rights organizations condemned the Maoists not just for their violence, but also for being anti-education and attacking schools. By the way, all the schools in the area are used as barracks for security forces. But in Dandakaranya, the Rani Bodli attack became a legend. Songs and poems and plays were written about it. The Maoist counter-offensive did break the carpet security and give people breathing space. The police and the Salvajurum retreated into their camps, from which they now emerge, usually in the dead of night, in packs of 300 or 1,000, to carry out cordon and search operations in villages. Gradually, except for the SPOs and their families, the rest of the people in the Salvajurum began to return to their villages. The Maoists welcomed them back and announced that even SPOs could return if they genuinely and publicly regretted their actions. Young people began to flock to the PLGA. The Salvajurum had not just failed, it had backfired badly. But as we know now, it was not just a local operation by a small-time hood. Regardless of the doublespeak in the press, the Salvajurum was a joint operation by the state government of Chhattisgarh and the Congress Party, which was in power at the center. It could not be allowed to fail. Not when all those MOUs were still waiting like wilting hopefuls on the marriage market. The government was under tremendous pressure to come up with a new plan. They came up with Operation Green Hunt. The Salvajurum SPOs are called Koya Commandos now. But the government has deployed the Chhattisgarh Armed Force, the Central Reserve Police Force, the Border Security Force, the Indo-Tibetan Border Police, the Central Industrial Security Force, Greyhounds, Scorpions, Cobras, and a policy that's affectionately called WAM, Winning Hearts and Minds. Significant wars are often fought in unlikely places. Free market capitalism defeated Soviet communism in the bleak mountains of Afghanistan. Here in the forests of Dantewada, a battle rages for the soul of India. Plenty has been said about the deepening crisis in Indian democracy and the collusion between big corporations, the media, major political parties, and the security establishment. If anyone wants to do a quick spot check, Dantewada is the place to go. A draft report on the state agrarian relations and the unfinished task of land reform said that Tata Steel and SR Steel were the first financiers of the Salvajurum. It was a government report and it created a flurry, so that fact was subsequently dropped. Was it a genuine error or did someone receive a gentle integrated steel tap on the shoulder? On the 12th of October 2009, at the mandatory public hearing for the Tata Steel plant meant to be held in Lohandigura, where local people could come, actually took place in a small hall inside the collectorate in Jagdalpur, many miles away, cordoned off with massive security. A hired audience of 50 tribal people was brought in a guarded convoy of government jeeps. After the meeting, the district collector congratulated the people of Lohandigura for their cooperation. The local newspapers reported the lie, even though they knew better, but the advertisements rolled in. And despite villagers' objections, land acquisition for the project began. The Maoists are not the only ones who seek to depose the Indian state. It's already been deposed several times by Hindu fundamentalism and economic totalitarianism. Lohandigura, a five-hour drive from Dantewada, never used to be a Naxalite area, but it is now. Comrade Juri, who sat next to me while I ate the red ant chutney, works in the area. She said they decided to move in after graffiti had begun to appear on the walls of village houses, saying, "Naxali aao, hame bachao. Naxals, come and save us." A few months ago, Vimal Meshram, vice president of the Janpad Panchayat, was shot dead in the market. He was Tata's man, jury says. He was forcing people to give up their land and accept compensation. It's good that he's been finished. Do you want some more chapoli, which is the chutney? She's crunching red ants. We won't let the Tatas come here. People don't want them. Juri is not PLGA. She's in the Chetna Natya Manch, the cultural wing of the party. She sings and writes songs. She's from Abujmar. I feel I ought to say something at this point about the futility of violence, about the unacceptability of summary executions. But what should I suggest they do? Go to court? Do a hunger strike in Jantar Mantar? A rally? A relay hunger strike? It sounds ridiculous. The promoters of the new economic policy, who find it so easy to say there is no alternative, should be asked to suggest an alternative resistance policy, a specific one to these specific people in this specific forest, here, now. Which party should they vote for? Which democratic institution in this country should they approach? Which door did the Narmada Andolan not knock on during the years and years it fought against big dams on the Narmada? Well, I just want to say, I think before I read the last bit of my book, that for many years I have been writing and following resistance movements and the new economic policy and all of that. And I've always found that the chances of coming upon despair are much greater in middle-class households than on the ground where people are actually fighting. Because middle-class people have the choice between hope and despair, you know, just like they have the choice between shampoo for dry hair or, you know, oily hair or whatever it is. They have the choice between doing politics or doing interior design. But people who are fighting, they really don't have a choice. They are fighting and they are focused and they know what they're doing. They're arguing, of course, with each other a lot. But that's all right. But when I came here to America, when I landed in New York, one of the first things I did was to go to the Wall Street occupation, because I wanted to see what was it, I mean, who were they, and what is that about, and how does it connect to the things that we've been fighting and writing about. Clearly, whatever all the various strands are, and the fact that they don't have demands, and the fact that it doesn't have identifiable leaders, still there is a connection between what's going on there and what's going on here, and that connection is that of exclusion. These are people who are excluded. They are clearly not the 400 families who own half the wealth of America, and they are not the 100 people in India who own 25% of India's GDP. So while all of us are people who believe in something, I mean, I think all of us in this room anyway are people who believe in revolution, who believe that the system must be brought down. But right now, for the moment at least, I was thinking that the least we can ask for to begin with is that there has to be a cap on all of this, you know, there has to be a lid on it. I thought, I'm a capist and a Lidite. and we do need to say a few things, you know. One is that no individual can have an unlimited amount of wealth. No corporation can have an unlimited amount of wealth. And this sort of cross-ownership of businesses really has to stop. In India, there are so many, of course. The Tatas are the biggest company. They own iron ore mines, steel mines, iodized salt, television channels. They manufacture trucks. They fund activists. They do everything. There's an iron ore and steel company called Jindals. They have iron ore mines, steel mines. The CEO is in parliament. He's a member of parliament. He's also the member of the National Flag Foundation because he won the right to fly the national flag on his house. They run a global law school just outside Delhi, which is like a Stanford campus in the midst of the most unbelievable squalor you can imagine, where they have faculty from all over the world paid huge salaries. They fund and promote cutting-edge artists who work in stainless steel. And they recently had a protest workshop. You know, so they flew in activists into this unbelievably posh campus, and then you had sort of protest poetry and protest slogans. And so they own everything. They own the resistance, they own the mines, they own the parliament, they own the flag, they own the newspapers. They don't let anything go. So these are some simple things that have to stop, that you just can't. Berlusconi owns 90% of the media in Italy, so what if he's not the prime minister? So it's a kind of insanity that's set in, which could have some simple solutions too. Like, for example, perhaps children shouldn't inherit the wealth their parents amass. You know? So I'm just going to read the end of the book and then I'll go away. Can we expect that an alternative to what looks like certain death for the planet will come from the imagination that has brought about this crisis in the first place? It seems unlikely. The alternative, if there is one, will emerge from the places and the people who have resisted the hegemonic impulse of capitalism and imperialism instead of being co-opted by it. Here in India, even in the midst of all the violence and greed, there is still hope. If anyone can do it, we can. We still have a population that has not been completely colonized by that consumerist dream. We still have a living tradition of those who have struggled for Gandhi's vision of sustainability and self-reliance, for socialist ideas of egalitarianism and social justice. We have Ambedkar's vision, which challenges the Gandhians as well as the socialists in serious ways. We have the most spectacular coalition of resistance movements with their experience, understanding, and vision. Most important of all, India has a surviving Adivasi, that's an indigenous population of almost 100 million. They're the ones who still know the secrets of sustainable living. If they disappear, they will take those secrets with them. Wars like Operation Green Hunt will make them disappear. So victories for the prosecutors of this war will contain within itself seeds of destruction, not just for Adivasis, but eventually for the human race. That's why the war in Central India is so important. That's why we need real and urgent conversations between all those political formations that are resisting this war. The day capitalism is forced to tolerate non-capitalist societies in its midst and to acknowledge limits in its quest for domination, the day it is forced to recognize that its supply of raw material will not be endless, is the day when change will come. If there is any hope for the world at all, it does not live in climate change conference rooms or in cities with tall buildings. It lives low down on the ground with its arms around the people who go to battle every day to protect their forests, their mountains, and their rivers, because they know that the forests, the mountains, and rivers protect them. The first step towards reimagining a world gone terribly wrong would be to stop the annihilation of those who have a different imagination, an imagination that is outside of capitalism as well as communism. an imagination which has an altogether different understanding of what constitutes happiness and fulfillment. To gain this philosophical space, it is necessary to concede some physical space for the survival of those who may look like the keepers of our past, but who may really be the guides to our future. To do this, we have to ask our rulers, can you leave the water in the rivers, the trees in the forest? Can you leave the bauxite in the mountain? If they say they cannot, then perhaps they should stop preaching morality to the victims of their wars.
Now, from India, we move to Canada. In the province of Alberta, they have what used to be called the tar sands. I think industry lobbyists decided that name sounded rather sticky, so they've been working hard to rebrand it as the oil sands. This is a radio adaptation of a film by Niobe Thompson entitled To the Last Drop.
This Canadian wilderness sits atop what many think is the biggest deposit of oil on the planet. A sea of sand soaked with bitumen. The tar sands. Once upon a time, nobody noticed the tar sands. But this is now the biggest construction project in the world. It's hard to miss. The tar sands now supply more oil to the United States than any other foreign source. A century of secure energy. Since 9/11, Canada has become the most important supplier of foreign oil to America. It's a market Canada can't afford to lose.
Don Thompson, president of the Oil Sands Development Group.
Even in the heart of the recession, the oil sands was spinning in the order of $20 billion a year into the Canadian economy. At that level, you will have employment in Canada dependent on oil sands of about 450,000 people. The oil sands are a key to the Canadian economy.
Ed Stelmach, Premier of the province of Alberta, Canada.
There is no greater partnership than the one we have between Alberta and the United States. The pace of oil sands expansion is positioning Alberta to become one of the world's top oil producers. We've barely scratched the surface of the oil sands development, and we're just getting started.
With dirty oil under fire, Premier Ed Stelmach shifts into gear and flies to Washington, launching a $25 million PR campaign with a speech in the U.S. Congress. Washington insider Paul Michael Wiebe clears the path to American decision makers.
The largest proven reserves in the world is Alberta. 8 times the reserve number that exists in Saudi Arabia.
How are you, sir?
Excellent.
Welcome to Washington.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Pleasure to have you.
As OPEC declines, Alberta, Western Canada rises. There is an ascendancy in Western Canada that is extraordinary. And American politicians are beginning to recognize that.
Hillary Clinton, U.S. Secretary of State.
We're either going to be dependent on dirty oil from the Gulf or dependent on dirty oil from Canada.
Dr. Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature.
Of course, the U.S. is equally complicit in the whole thing. We're the junkie that's buying the drugs that Canada's peddling.
The tar sands are impossible to ignore. Pressure is mounting to build a huge new pipeline from Alberta to refineries in Texas. It will cement the hold of Canada's dirty oil on the U.S. market for a generation. The Alberta tar sands lie under boreal forests drained by the Athabasca River as it flows northward. Where the river empties into the lake, it forms one of the world's great freshwater delta ecosystems.
Jack Woodward, author of Native Law.
Under Canadian law and British imperial law, the Cree people owned that part of Alberta. The most important promise in the treaty is that the Cree Indians would have the right to hunt and fish. Except now, if you look at northern Alberta, particularly northeastern Alberta, where the tar sands developments are, the developments are so vast, the disruption of the landscape is so extensive, that it's now fair to say the treaty rights themselves can no longer be meaningfully exercised because the habitat of the animals is being destroyed right before our eyes.
For Chief Alan Adam and generations of his people, the land is life. Then one day, the land changed. The world's largest corporations came looking for oil. On the shores of Lake Athabasca sits tiny Fort Chipewyan. Population, 1,027. In 2008, thousands of migrating ducks land on a lake of toxic waste. The disaster makes headlines around the world. As the labeled dirty oil begins to stick, the industry shoots back with a reminder. The world needs energy, and Canada needs the tar sands. An article in National Geographic describes tar sands refineries as dark, satanic mills. Canadian politicians strike back.
Stephen Harper, Canadian Prime Minister.
Carbon emissions from coal-fired electricity in the United States are 40 times the emissions of the oil sands.
Michael Ignatieff, former leader of the opposition.
Am I proud of this industry? You bet. It's a world leader. We just need to make it better. But I don't take lessons from the National Geographic.
Alan Adam, Dene Chief, Fort Chipewyan.
When I entered into politics, I thought we were going to cash in on the economic development in the region and be part of the whole atmosphere and work on it from there. But then as we got into it, 7, 8, 9 people were diagnosed with cancer in the last 2 years that have passed on. And that's an alarming number that we have to deal with. We live by the lakeshore of Lake Athabasca, and the river flows down from the Athabasca River. You could put two and two together. It's our turn now to say enough is enough.
Joni Wandering Spirit, president of Fort Chipewyan, in her rather bare house, with a lot of photos of friends and family on the walls.
There was my uncle Raymond. He had died with a brain tumor. And my granny, she died with cancer. And my auntie Albina, the coin, her too with cancer. And my uncle Knapp on this side up here, him too, he had died with a brain tumor. So it's brain tumors and cancer they mostly died of. I moved down here 9 years ago from Edmonton, Lac La Beche, to come raise my kids down here because I grew up here. This community is supposed to be a good community to raise your family. Both my sisters both got cancer, and I'm just worried my kids will end up getting it, or I will end up getting it. My parents. Everybody grieves.
Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Tar Sands, Dirty Oil.
Arsenic is a very clear-cut carcinogen. It's a cancer maker, and it is associated with bitumen production.
Bitumen is defined as any of the various mixtures of hydrocarbons as tar, often together with their non-metallic derivatives that occur naturally or are obtained as residues after heat refining into petroleum.
The more you process those deposits, the more you're going to bring arsenic and lead and other heavy metals to the surface. And if you're not careful, over time, you will see larger and larger pulses of arsenic and other cancer makers enter waterways.
Ray Ladouceur, commercial fisherman, Fort Chipewyan.
Yeah, when Grandpa came on into this part of the country and he fell in love with the Delta, because everything was so plentiful, birds, muskrat, you name it. He was 86 years old when he quit trapping. I don't know if I'll ever reach that. You know, there's quite a few people been having cancer, and I always believe it's something to do with the water. And plus, the fish that we eat from Lake Athabasca. It's supposed to be 2 or 3 different types of cancer. Young people died from it.
The community relies heavily on traditional foods here. If the water is affected and the animals are drawn to the water to survive, and, you know, it could be within the traditional foods itself.
Larry Paquette, commercial fisherman, Fort Chipewyan.
Well, I don't think anybody eats fish anymore.
Yeah.
We don't, anyway. They're deformed, like, they're bent over, some of them humpbacked and crooked. And Some of them, the cheeks are just eaten right off. It's like acid ate them.
Dr. John O'Connor, physician, Fort Chipewyan.
I began to notice patients had lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and bile duct cancers. Statistically, I'm not supposed to see more than one in 100,000. It is certainly one that can be connected directly with toxins in the environment.
Hello.
I felt a baseline health study should be undertaken, and that didn't happen. The very first visit by the group of physicians from Health Canada, this physician went into the kitchen, grabbed a mug filled with water from the sink, took a swig, put it down, and basically turned and said to her, there's nothing wrong with the water here in Port Chip. I thought that was a real shocker, and the community reacted predictably to that. They were very angry that this had happened, and it was a kind of a kick in the face, I guess.
But instead of a cancer study, Dr. O'Connor found himself the target of an investigation. The list of accusations against the doctor was long. He was charged with raising undue alarm in Fort Chipewyan. His reputation under fire, O'Connor had no choice but to leave his practice.
Cookie Simpson, Cree elder and former nurse.
They caused undue alarm to us by doing what they did to our doctor, that the whole community respected. And it wasn't right what they did. And they never consulted with us at all, so the governments were in the wrong.
Dr. Gina Solomon, Professor of Medicine, University of California.
I looked into some of the types of cancers that are particularly elevated in Fort Chipewyan, and it's interesting, a lot of them have been linked to hydrocarbon exposures, in other words, exposures to oil and petroleum products. Leukemia and lymphoma, biliary tract cancer, and surprisingly, a very rare cancer called soft tissue sarcoma. As a physician, I've practiced medicine for many years. I've actually never seen a case of soft tissue sarcoma. It's a tragic and very, almost always fatal cancer. And it was surprising to see even two cases in a town this small.
In the 1970s, David Schindler's research led to banning harmful phosphates in detergent. He was pivotal in the global fight to curb acid rain. Now he's turning his attention to the tar sands. Over the years, Schindler has watched governments turn water monitoring in the Athabasca River over to industry-funded consultants.
Dr. David Schindler, Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta.
There have been papers that have come out recently showing that you can't reclaim the aquifers, that you can't reclaim the wetlands, that the cost of any reasonable reclamation are so high that there would be no money made on the oil sands. I don't think people realize how big the sacrifice zone is going to be. It's an area slightly bigger than Greece, a third the size of Norway.
The Alberta government claims the tar sands leave the Athabasca River unpolluted, but Schindler is not convinced.
These pollutants are emerging pollutants. The first time it was really shown that at low concentrations they could have long-term impacts was at the Exxon Valdez. Sea otters and some of the waterfowl are still being affected 18 years after the spill. A lot of these same compounds are in high concentrations in the tar sands. They're toxic at parts per trillion.
The wilderness affected by industry will dwarf what we see today.
I've been a commercial fisherman for 53 years in the whole Lake Athabasca. I had never, ever seen deformed fish in my younger days. And I had lost at least 8 members of my family on cancer. Sometimes when I think about it, I get pretty upset what they had done to our lake and our waters and whatever we have over there to survive on.
And fishermen are showing the increasingly commonly found deformed fish.
We hired Aaron Kelly to do this. Her specialty had been mercury. And Jeff Short, who'd worked around the Exxon Valdez for 20 years and had developed some really state-of-the-art techniques for monitoring polycyclic aromatics.
Dr. Aaron Kelly, biologist from the University of Alberta.
We're sampling for metals and pH, and we're looking at different media, including fish, water, vegetation. In the wintertime, we did snow sampling. I became a part of this project because of the controversy surrounding it and because I think that this river and the people that live on it deserve some good science to answer some questions that a lot of people are asking.
Knowing their findings could be controversial, Schindler's researchers are extremely careful in their methods.
We spent months intercalibrating our measurements with those by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. Our other analyses were all done by certified laboratories because they're the only kind of evidence that will stand up in court. We've covered our bases in a lot of ways that most university research wouldn't.
Oil sands are a very unique resource, and oil sands development does bring unique environmental challenges. Alberta's oil sands are concentrated near the Earth's surface. Contaminants are picked up naturally through waterways and enter the ecosystem. As a province, we monitor water quality carefully, and to date, all of the data shows no long-term effects to water quality from oil sands development.
In the mining operation, you're exposing all kinds of stuff to the air and to the wind. You dig the bitumen out of the ground, you've got to take out all of the coke in it, you've got to add a whole bunch of hydrogen, and that's a very energy-intensive process, so you've got lots of air pollution coming from that. A third of the country's nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxides are all coming from oil and gas facilities in Alberta, and the majority of all that is coming from the Fort McMurray area. For every barrel of bitumen, you create a barrel and a half of toxic waste that goes into a tailings pond. Those tailings ponds are all made of unlined sand, and the majority of them are leaking. The whole stream of production from beginning to end is very industrial, very messy, and has got pollutants associated with each and every stage.
Rob Renner, Alberta's Minister for the Environment.
We have some very large industrial projects here that, to the uninformed eye, appear to be out of control. The fact of the matter is that this is one of the most highly regulated industries that there is in the world. This is anything but the Wild West.
Confused? You'll just have to trust the minister. He controls a program to monitor water pollution in the tar sands. But the results are confidential. It's paid for by the oil companies, and they own the data. All the public hears is that year after year, water quality in the Athabasca River is unchanged. It's just not a problem.
2005, they said no significant changes. 2008, no detectable changes. 2009, no substantial changes. François Paulette, hereditary dean chief.
Oh, hi, your water used to come here?
Oh, hi.
Yeah?
Up to here. See the shoreline here?
Uh-huh.
Water's been gone down quite a bit, eh?
For sure, yeah.
Though we're over 100 miles from McMurray, we are affected, definitely affected. This river here, as we know it, it's not the same anymore, not the same. When I travel on the river, I got to bring fresh drinking water. You just about nearly have to have a UN envoy, somebody from the UN monitoring what's happening, like they're monitoring Afghanistan. Who is monitoring this river here? It's our survival. It's the survival of our people. If we kill the river, then where are we going to turn to?
In 1899, François Paulette's grandfather signed a treaty with the British Crown. As a 22-year-old chief in the 1970s, Paulette went to the Supreme Court to argue Canada had let down its side of the bargain. He won the case. His victory changed Canadian law and launched the era of native land claims. François brings Alan Adam to a meeting of the Dene Nation, whose chiefs come from settlements stretching to the Arctic Ocean. Like Fort Chipewyan, they're all downstream of the tar sands.
A lot of chiefs have differences when it comes to issues related to the community. The only one common goal that they could relate to is land and then water. The land that ties the people together and the water that makes you survive off the island. 40 years development has been going on in the region and we're feeling the impacts here today. Another 40 years of development in the region, you're going to feel the impacts of it tomorrow. So you have to start intervening, start raising your voices. But if I am left to fight this battle alone and that without the support of others, sadly to say that I have no other option but to make an agreement with industry and government.
Ronald Wright, author of A Short History of Progress.
Throughout history, really, and even going back into prehistory, human beings often make a discovery or an invention that seems to offer wonderful things, but the very things that make them thrive and grow and prosper are the same things that bring them down in the end. That's a classic progress trap. I think that's very apparent in modern times. I mean, we have bought into industrial civilization on a big scale. We actually believe that things will always get bigger and better and everybody will get richer. And that's not only a progress trap, but it's also what is sometimes called an ideological pathology, an idea that is deadly.
In Kyoto, Canada promised to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 6%. Now, 20 years later, the tar sands are booming and emissions are up 26%. If the tar sands were a country, their emissions would equal Switzerland's.
Dr. Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature.
If you set out to devise a method to warm the planet, you couldn't come up with a better one than what Canada is doing at the tar sands. You've got to bring in energy to heat this stuff up enough to get it out. Once you've spent all that energy getting it out, then you refine it into gasoline and burn it again. If any significant portion of that tar sands continues to get exploited and burnt, then we'll simply have too much carbon in the atmosphere.
Dr. Tim Flannery, author of The Weathermakers.
For every barrel of oil that you get from the tar sands, you release three times as much carbon as you do from a conventional oil well in Texas or Saudi Arabia. So there's a big carbon liability there. If the whole world followed Canada down that route, which we could, we've all got, you know, oil shales or other, you know, carbon-dense forms of hydrocarbons, we would cook the earth.
George Monbiot, columnist for The Guardian.
Canada has, in the run-up to Copenhagen, done a great deal to sabotage the efforts of the other nations, and it did more damage than any other nation on Earth. And it seems so strange to think, what is the biggest threat to a good global deal at the moment? It's not Saudi Arabia, it's not the US, it's not even China. Canada? How could it be Canada?
Stephen Harper, Canadian Prime Minister.
It is important that we have a good environmental record and good environmental image. I think often the case is that the oil sands has gotten more criticism than it deserves.
Dr. Andrew Weaver, climatologist from the University of Victoria.
It's very clear to me that the current administration believes that the tar sands are the economic engine for Canada's future prosperity. So we have lost credibility internationally. There's no question that Canada is viewed as a laggard and an obstructionist on the international scene.
Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature.
Copenhagen is a very good example of why you can't treat climate change like all the other political issues that we face. Normally we move slowly as we address political issues, and that makes sense. In this case, that doesn't work so well, because your opponent is not the Republicans, it's not the Chinese, it's not... Your opponent is physics. And physics isn't going to slowly change its mind. And it's making its presence felt. The Arctic is melting. Glaciers are melting. Drought and flood are spreading relentlessly. The world is shifting in the most profound ways we've ever seen it in as a human civilization. Political reality is very powerful, but it's trumped by scientific reality.
Professor Schindler is worried about the confusion, so he's challenged government scientists to a debate at the University of Alberta.
Dr. David Schindler, Professor of Ecology from the University of Alberta.
With all of this competing data, how are ordinary citizens able to digest that?
I think industry likes it that way. As long as there's confusion, there won't be any regulation. I've seen this with phosphates and detergents, with acid rain, with big tobacco. We're seeing it as we speak with climate. It's a standard industry tactic. Get all sorts of voices, so there's a muddle. It appears that the teeter-totter swings. It doesn't tip one way. And every year that you can get away with lack of regulation is a few billion more bucks in your pocket. After 40 years, I'm pretty sick of seeing this tactic fool people time after time. Maybe we all did just fall off a turnip truck.
Professor Schindler's research is complete. The findings are disturbing. The people of Fort Chipewyan will be the first to hear them. Schindler's research is the first independent project to study pollution in the water flowing through the tar sands. As the first results come in, Schindler and his team have made an alarming discovery. Schindler's team has discovered cancer-causing heavy metals in the entire ecosystem, reaching as far north as Fort Chipewyan itself. They're in Fort Chipewyan with the news. Chief Adam and his community were always told that whatever was in their water was natural. Most tar sands operations are near the Athabasca River. As long as the government claims toxins in the water are from natural erosion of bitumen formations along the Athabasca River, industry can't be blamed. But Schindler and his team have found a way to test the natural runoff claim. They sampled in winter. Half the year, the tar sands are covered by snow and ice. What ends up in the snow can only get there from smokestacks and dust from the mines. If Schindler could detect toxins in the snow, they must be from industrial activity. Within a 50-kilometer radius, that's exactly what the researchers found.
Within that 50-kilometer circle, there was 11,400 metric tons of particulate deposited during only 4 months of snowfall, and 64% of that was bitumen. If that was released as a pulse, you could have snowmelt runoff that is equivalent to a major oil spill repeated annually.
The metals that we're focusing on here are the 13...
Schindler presents the results. Tar sands plants are releasing 13 toxic heavy metals into the river, including arsenic, lead, mercury, chromium, and cadmium.
One thing that is really odd is that while industry is denying that anything is going into the river, they have to report their emissions to Environment Canada. They've tripled the output of mercury into the environment between 2001 and 2008. The same thing for lead. Lead's gone up fourfold in 6 years. The same for arsenic. It's gone up threefold in 7 years. We conclude that the oil sands industry is adding substantial amounts of contaminants to the river.
Dr. Gina Solomon, professor of medicine from the University of California.
The cancer rates in this community are quite a bit higher than would be expected. The rates of leukemias and lymphomas were about three times higher than would be expected. The rates of bile duct cancer were seven times higher than expected. The things that are interesting and worrisome about those particular cancers is that they have already, in scientific studies, been linked to exposures to petroleum products. I can't say what's causing the cancers here in Fort Chipewyan. There's something causing it. We need to work together to find out what that something is.
My name is Crystal Ravitz. I'm 31 years old, and I found out that I might have ovarian cancer, waiting on my ultrasound results. How do you tell your kids that you're sick? How do you explain to them when they've already lost so many family members to cancer? It's the hardest thing in the world to tell them. Something has to be done. I love my home, I love the people around me, and I don't want to lose any more people. especially family, especially me for my kids. Thank you.
Our people have to eat too. They're working down there. They have to support their families. They have no choice. And I'm kind of stuck because I got a lot of family members down there. But I also don't want them to. I don't want to bury them too.
I work for the plants. I worked for them for 5 years. So I think we have to all take a hard look at ourselves and say, do we want those jobs and keep dying?
Right now, I think there's about 10 or so active mines running, up and running. I believe that's something like 42 more coming up, 42 proposed projects. Like the numbers that we're showing, or you guys are showing us today, would that be times 42 in the future? Because I think that the signs are there, the numbers are going up, it's only going to get worse. I don't want to see it go tenfold anymore. Earlier on today, I witnessed this whole room stand up all at once. That's strength. That's unity. That's what this town was lacking for the last 40 years. Now I believe we have it. Now that we have it, let's use it. Let's do something.
I have a 2.5-year-old son right now. I have one more on the way. You know, I don't want him and my unborn child standing here in my shoes at my age telling the same story again. You know, I want him to tell a totally different story. I want him to say that, yeah, we got industry here and they're cleaning up the mess that they made.
Andrew Nikiforuk, author of Tar Sands Dirty Oil.
We know for sure that the oldest tailings dike built by Suncor back in 1965 has been leaking continually into the Athabasca River for more than 30 years. The management of this waste has become a huge issue. The ponds keep on growing and growing. They get higher and higher and higher to accommodate more and more waste. We could now fill enough 45-gallon drums to stretch to the moon and back 15 times.
The research is published. The revelations spark a media storm. At first, Alberta's government dismisses the evidence.
Rob Renner, Minister of the Environment for Alberta.
There are compounds in the Athabasca River that are naturally occurring, have been there for thousands of years and will always be there because of the nature of the geology in that area.
Okay, but there's a study refuting what you've just said. The study says that humans are causing it. You have nothing to point to that would refute that.
I don't believe that's what the study said.
It doesn't seem to matter how good a research plan we put together. We're supposed to believe that they have a database out there somewhere that refutes everything that we've shown. Well, we have our data out there for public display. Let's see theirs.
You can't give a peer-reviewed data.
I have.
Spurred by Schindler's research, Ottawa appoints a high-level review panel to examine the quality of water monitoring in the tar sands. This time, the minister can't push the story away.
A couple of smartly dressed people sitting down in front of some flags and a notice announcing it was the advisory panel report on oil sands. Elizabeth Dowderswell, chair of the Oil Sands Advisory Panel, former executive director of the UN Environment Programme.
The panel was unanimous in its findings. Do we have a world-class monitoring system in place? In short, no. We found that the activities were not always credible because they lacked scientific rigor.
For far too long, we have heard concerns about the quality of water downstream of the oil sands. This panel has told us that Canada needs to build a world-class environmental monitoring system for the oil sands and that that need is absolutely urgent. The actions we take will be guided by science and by facts, not by politics and public relations.
For Fort Chipewyan's downriver people, good science is a matter of life and death, but their battle isn't over. Monitoring may not be enough.
There's about 7 or 8 active mines right now that are tearing up, ripping apart Mother Earth right now as we speak, and there's another 26 more coming. You know, so right now I vow not to let that happen. You know, so people say, you know, this is a David and Goliath situation. You're going up against these giant companies, these giant corporations. I say, hey, look, you know, like, once you start thinking of these people as giants, you know, you're going to lose, you're going to fail.
Recently, the Alberta government did look at the rate of cancer in Fort Chipewyan. The results confirmed what whistleblower John O'Connor had feared, a significantly higher rate of cancer than expected. The study also turned up rare forms of cancer associated with oil pollution. But then the Alberta government issued a statement reassuring the people of Fort Chipewyan. Apparently, there was no cause for alarm. Stocking up on winter meat is a way of life for the Dene in these isolated communities. The buffalo wintering grounds are 300 kilometers downriver from Fort Chipewyan. And Francois Paulette worries that even their meat carries poisons from the tar sands.
This is a very unique life that we continue to live. And it's in jeopardy. We have rights to hunt, we have rights to trap, and we have rights to livelihood. What good is all that rights going to be when everything is taken away from us? We will have a treaty with all our rights, with no place to practice it in. When you start hearing the kids in the community saying that they hate the way the shovel sounds when it hits the sand, because we're burying another community member, you could tell what already is being embedded into the heads of the younger generation, because we were not used to it. It's a tough challenge to be an elected leader where you speak out for the people. Any leader should speak out for the people.
Every major oil company on the planet is now building in the tar sands. Production will triple by 2020. The first wave of investment came from companies, BP, Exxon, Shell, and Total. Now it's countries like China, India, and South Korea pouring in the cash.
Ever since we got hooked on oil, we became committed to this idea of exponential growth because oil permitted it. Oil allowed us to globalize, allowed us to change agriculture, massive population growth, massive concentration of people in cities. That's all been a function of oil.
We are beggaring the future. We're not only destroying other cultures and other species, but we are beggaring our own descendants by indulging in this oil-fueled binge and just burning up the planet's deposit of liquid hydrocarbon in a matter of 100 years or so.
If the development of the tar sands has one good thing about it, it might be that it wakes us up. Business as usual is over. We've run out of time. It is the tipping point. It's telling us that everything about fossil fuel economies have changed in terms of cost, in terms of scale, in terms of environmental footprint. Everything has changed.
Not long ago, this was a massive strip mine. Now the hole is filled in, and buffalo graze on reclaimed land alongside tailings ponds of toxic waste. When the oil runs out, industry promises that this is what they'll leave behind: picnic grounds and replanted forests.
We're in Treaty 8 territory. What that means is that if you're going to do anything with the land, they need to ask us. We've never sold this land. We've never gave it up. We never surrendered it. But people still think that we have the right to come in here and do what you want to do.
You still catch me napping one day.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's a Twitter feed announcing new episodes and a mailing list if you're interested in helping with the show, either by reading or contributing ideas or taking part in the discussion. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.